right now, the world needs good people to step up and stand up for what they believe and to do it in a different way to the way they've done it before. We can't afford for philanthropy to be sitting on the sidelines, because right now, civil society is under attack. All the causes that we care about so dearly, not just in our world, in the peace-building world, but whether it's sexual and reproductive health, women's rights, gay rights, poverty alleviation, whatever those causes are, they're all under attack right now.
How do you drive change in a world of chaos? When grants are vanishing, institutional funding is drying up, and philanthropic organisations are struggling to continue backing local actors. I'm Jasmine Cato Norton. Welcome back to the Building Peace podcast from Peace Direct. This is the first of two special bonus episodes on decolonising philanthropy at a time when global funding is under real pressure. In this episode, you'll hear from my colleagues who have been closely involved in our decolonising philanthropy consultation.
I'm Enrica Larusso, and I'm a Senior Research Officer at Peace Direct.
My name is Sam Crocker, and I'm the Programme Development Manager at Peace Direct.
Hi everyone, I'm Dylan Matthews, and I'm the Chief Executive at Peace Direct.
They'll share what they've learned, reflect on the key concerns raised by groups in the Global South, and explore where we go from here.
This all started because about 2 years ago, Peace Direct carried out a research process with a global consultation that involved over 190 people from over 50 different countries. And we asked them to share their thoughts, their views, their personal experiences about working with the philanthropic or within the philanthropic sector, and also asking them if they could reimagine it, how would they see it in the future changing? So we heard from a broad mix of people, from locally based practitioners, from grassroots organizations, as well as members of foundations and funding bodies, and staff of intermediary organizations or INGOs like ourselves. Some of the most critical things we heard were about how the philanthropic sector is heavily shaped by neocolonial attitudes, ideologies, and beliefs. Some of them, for example, resembling mistrust in the Global South, where many funders assume that local actors don't necessarily have the competence or integrity to work independently. And sometimes this mistrust also extends to financial accountability. And so this often leads to overburdening due diligence.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because it might be worth here sort of thinking about who we're talking about, because one thing I've thought often is that the word philanthropy encapsulates a lot of different types of organizations. So you've got your small family foundations who, you know, in the UK, there are thousands of very small foundations who are giving sort of less than £10,000 maybe each year. And then right up to your sort of Bill and Melinda Gates or your Carnegie corporations, et cetera. So these sort of historical philanthropists who are sort of the size of a small country, they have the ability to change things quicker than, say, a institutional government funder would be able to. So I think that's kind of where it's interesting for me. A lot of the things we're talking about here are learned practices that have existed for a long time, and they're rooted in some various long-standing historical attitudes towards how you do this sort of thing.
There's many other ways in which these attitudes manifest themselves, even philanthropy being perceived as being ego-driven, where funders focus on the impact of their gift, their visibility, or a sense of virtue in the work that they do. And so what we heard from a lot of people is that all of these attitudes basically emulate a neocolonial model of philanthropy. For example, victimizing recipients who are often portrayed as helpless or in need saving. And so some of these attitudes and beliefs then manifest in behaviors, for example, learning to talk the talk of funders, where Global South organizations often feel compelled to adopt Western language or Western values or processes in order to be considered eligible for funding. That's something that we've heard quite clearly from many testimonies.
I think one of the things that I've observed in my role talking not only to philanthropists, but also to INGOs, policymakers, is that all of them are operating within a system that doesn't work for local actors, and yet they're not necessarily aware of the system. So they operate within their own silo. I mean, I think we talked about that in the consultation as well. You know, how do we change the system in which philanthropy operates? Don't just think about a philanthropist's attitudes and practices, but the fact that the entire system has evolved over generations to think of certain groups as having more superior knowledge than other groups, certain attitudes being dominant over other attitudes. And we see that in geopolitics. We see that in the way that the humanitarian aid and development sector has operated. And why would we think that philanthropy would be any different? Sam?
Yeah, and it's a really good question, Dylan. It's taken a while for the sector to kind of get to the point where they're acknowledging and challenging these sorts of things. And a lot of these people, especially in the kind of bigger organizations, you know, thousands of people. And if you've got a grants manager who's kind of, you know, in their 30s, maybe they have some kids, they've got to pay a mortgage and stuff, like, it's quite hard work for them to rapidly question everything that they've chosen to do up until this point. So there's a kind of existential question here, which could be applied for people who work for NGOs as well, I think, and we would include ourselves in that. I think the levers for change really, for me, sit at the kind of leadership level. You know, particularly in the UK, for example, we have this sort of trustee, board of trustee kind of model. And it's fairly standardized that on your board of trustees, you'll have few people who have maybe worked for other charities, and then various people who worked in the business world. And they are the people who are ultimately accountable for the success of the organization. So I think there's some fundamental, almost like governance issues there, to be honest with you. I know that's not very like interesting and sexy subject to kind of bring up, but it's a thing that's not talked about enough, I think.
Sam, you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that it reminds me of is our Time to Decolonize Aid report, and the consultation that we held now almost 5 years ago, where one of the main recommendations was, you know, organizations in the global north aren't very diverse. They don't have people with lived experience. And therefore, how can they have a real understanding of the issues that they are trying to tackle? The request that was made back then was to the global north, become more diverse organizations. Have people with lived experience. Don't just have people with 2 or 3 degrees, or the people who are joining your board simply because it's a nice thing for their CV or it's an ego boost. I think that recommendation still applies. And I think right now it's very hard because, of course, there's an attack on diversity, equity, inclusion from various parts of the world. We know from the US government, but not just the US government. There's a sort of this anti-woke agenda, this attack on progressive causes. And so I think right now it's really hard for foundations to examine their own structures, their own governance, because they now are being attacked in certain parts of the world by their own governments, who are saying this is an agenda that we will punish you for supporting. So I'm just wondering, Enrica, when you were part of the philanthropy consultation, to what extent did you see foundations really reflecting on their own power, their positionality, the need to be more diverse organizations? Did that come up?
We really felt like if we are to have this conversation, we need to hear from every side of the table. And some of the people that we heard from are philanthropic organizations that we also work closely with. And they did have a lot of important and inspiring examples to share about how they've started questioning the membership to their own boards and established quotas in terms of consultations with grantees, trying to advocate for less extractive practices, having more genuine conversations about why they need funding and what they would use it for without the expectation that they would have all the answers from the get-go. So releasing some of the pressure as well and trying as much as possible to ease the burden on grantees so that they could focus on doing the important work that they do. And I don't think we haven't heard that was impossible. There are ways that you can still follow the rules of the system while also trying to challenge some of the more formal practices that are still within those rules, but could make the difference for people that receive these grants.
One thing that definitely came up from the report is that people need to acknowledge their colonial roots and the colonial roots of the sector. The most tangible of cases, I think, we've seen an organization like Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust, who have not only applied that to their work, but they've done some research into where did their endowment come from. You know, these are often businesses in the majority of cases. And in the case of Joseph Rowntree, it originated from slavery and cocoa plantations in West Africa. So, you know, they did that research and they said, we've looked into this, we've gone into our archives, this is where it came from. And we're here to say, we acknowledge that and we're going to respond in the way we do things. And I think that's a very impressive and sort of noble move, really, to do that. And so many other organizations could learn from it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Sam. And that's also what we heard from people during the consultation, that yes, this deep work within is very important to understand where the harms may have been done, even if unintentionally. And for example, quite a few people were already a bit critical or disappointed that the decolonizing movement isn't moving from the talk to the practice. You can't get to the final stage and look at a completely changed system if you don't do the hard work of looking inward and really questioning why and how you're doing some things.
Enrica, I just wanted to come back to you on that point about the deep work. So I am lucky enough to speak to philanthropists, to policymakers, to lots of NGOs around the world who are keen to learn more and keen to explore some of these issues. What they ask is, I think, quite unrealistic, which is they want a blueprint for how you do that. How do you do that inner work? And I keep saying to them, I don't think there is a blueprint. That doesn't exist. In our second report, which is on decolonizing peace building, we looked at the recommendations that came out and put them into three different baskets. And I think those three baskets are worth reminding people of. The first basket of recommendations is around worldviews, norms, and values. So what the participants from the Global South were saying is, do the hard work. It starts with you. And it's based on some fundamental assumptions and values and norms and worldviews that you hold, which you have to challenge. The second basket focuses on attitudes. So think about how you reframe the notion of who's an expert and who is not an expert, what professionalism means. And the third basket is about practice. So once you've understood and you've looked at the norms, values, and your attitudes and assumptions, then you can work on practice. And what we see in the sector, and this is not just with philanthropy, but also with NGOs, is that they jump to the practice. They want the quick fix. And that's part of the problem the sector has. We like the superficial quick wins, and we don't want to do that hard work. When you look at, for example, the Grand Bargain Agreement, which is, you know, a set of agreements at the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016, they were looking at how to shift more money to local actors. They agreed a target, which was 25% of funding to go to local actors. That target was set in 2016. As of last year, the proportion has gone down. So we are going backwards. And the reason is, I think, that most organizations are afraid to look at doing the deeper work. So one of the conversations I'd like to have with you here is, in this current environment, how do we ensure that the movement or the hard work isn't lost or disappears because people are afraid to have it right now, or that they're dealing with their own crises?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Dylan, it's an incredibly hard time as institutional funders shrink and cut budgets and whatnot. They are inundated with people saying, help, my USA grant's just been cut. Can you kind of support us to continue existing? Nevertheless, I think, you know, that in many ways, now is a moment of reckoning when you can begin to have those conversations, really. Sometimes the house needs to burn down to rebuild it again. And so I think, I hope they're able to make the space for that in amongst everything that's going on.
And also, just to say, going back to the point that we said earlier about how philanthropy is trying to figure this out by themselves, they don't have to. We've heard from so many local actors that there are already local initiatives, including philanthropic initiatives, in place. They have been for the longest time. So maybe it's not a time to burn the house down, but just to reconstruct it together. And it's an opportunity to shape a new kind of partnership, a new relationship, and also practice some of that mutual learning that is always so preached, but so rarely has the time and opportunity to be really nurtured. People are able in times, especially in times of crisis, which are more common to them than perhaps they are to philanthropic organizations, to pull resources together, to come together as a community and try to fill any gaps that mostly Global North funders may have left when project cycles end, when projects are terminated abruptly. So this is a time not to come up with some magic solution, but perhaps rather to try to reconceive how philanthropy can work and should work with partners, especially because it's a time of need for everyone.
It reminds me again of one of the recommendations from the Decolonize Aid report, which was that the Global South are asking the Global North to create a culture in your own organizations of openness to critique. And what they're saying is, if we are, as Enrica said, if we're going to reconstruct the house together, then we have to acknowledge the mistakes that we've made. That's just good practice, whether you're a builder, whether you're a project manager, whether you're a researcher, you know, acknowledge the mistakes that you've made, recognize where you've gone wrong, and let's learn and build together. But I think organizations have built up their egos and their reputations and their success on singing their successes and hiding their failures, hiding their weaknesses. And I think the sector is weaker and poorer as a result of it. It's a difficult time to be in the sector, whether you're a philanthropist or whether you're at the receiving end of the philanthropy. So I think one of the messages is, you're not alone. Find the people who can work with you and talk about this in a safe space, I suppose.
Yeah, we've been lucky to work with one fund in particular who have said kind of, okay, let's do away with all that. Let's work as peers, share learnings, talk about what we know, talk about what we don't know. And I think that's been a fantastic step in the right direction, I think.
Enrica, we've talked about some of the recommendations that have come out of the consultation, but were there any others that struck you from the consultation that resonate with you or you think are particularly important right now?
There is one that has really stuck with me for a long time because it was a clear request for funders not just to change their practices, but also show up for movements in the ways that their partners need the most, using their own power as philanthropic actors and their own privilege in their positions to advance joint advocacy goals. And I think this is what we're seeing right now in a time of crisis, as we said before, where so many of these goals and values are under attack, including physical attack, and where entire organizations and people's livelihoods have been put at risk. This is a time where it's important to show community, and that should transcend the grantee-grantor relationship. It's something that partners have been asking for before, and it's become even more paramount right now. Philanthropic organizations and actors have the privilege of having more of an independent voice compared to, for example, institutional actors. And so I think what was coming out of the consultation was also this sense of responsibility to use that power and that autonomy to stand by local actors in times of need. And what better moment to do that than now?
How do you guys feel about kind of how philanthropy is doing, if you will? Yeah, we've talked about some bad things, we talked about some good things, but yeah, Dylan, I don't know, what's your perspective?
The sector is undergoing some huge shocks to the system, both in terms of political pressures that are influencing the way philanthropy should operate, but also the lack of funding. So it is a mixed picture. On the one hand, you have the donor statement on supporting locally led development is a really good example of philanthropy coming together with bilateral donors to say, we can do better. And those recommendations were quite powerful. The first one was shift and share power. We need to shift and share power. The second was about actually channeling more money as directly as possible to local actors. And the third was around advocating more for locally led efforts. Those were good commitments, and yet we haven't seen enough progress. So we can see the rhetoric is there. That's not enough. We have to see practice change. I think the sector is now looking for who are the champions, who is going to take this up and move forward. To any philanthropist who might be listening to this, don't wait too long. Right now, the world needs good people to step up and stand up for what they believe and to do it in a different way to the way they've done it before. We can't afford for philanthropy to be sitting on the sidelines, because right now, civil society is under attack. All the causes that we care about so dearly, not just in our world, in the peace-building world, but whether it's sexual and reproductive health, women's rights, gay rights, poverty alleviation, whatever those causes are, they're all under attack right now. And so philanthropy needs to meet this moment. Right now, I'm not seeing that happening. I don't believe that's because there's a lack of willingness. I think there's just a bit of analysis paralysis. Find your allies, work with others, and also engage with civil society. There was a important open letter by a whole network of civil society organizations. Peace Direct was part of that, and it was called Stand With Civil Society. And it had requests for philanthropy to reimagine the system with them. So don't, as philanthropy, sit in your corner as you would have done in the past in your ivory tower, thinking about how you want to reshape international cooperation or how you want to help particular causes. Do that with civil society.
Yeah, Enrico, you were obviously very involved in this consultation we talked about earlier. Was there any sort of positive stories which you could see which maybe people can take as inspiration?
I remember very clearly a testimony from a participant from Uganda who said that a group of local organizations there had put together a request that they then put forward to funders for what initiatives they were interested in receiving funds for. And this is what in the sector we would call a reverse call for funding, which is a very innovative way of local actors coming together to say to funders, this is what we're interested in, listen to us, and if you're interested, then we can have a conversation about how your funding can better adapt to our needs. That's, to me, very innovative, but it should be such a simple and intuitive way of reshaping some of these decision-making dynamics. And it could be so much easier for philanthropic organizations as well, because they would have to spend less time figuring out what it is that their funding is needed for. It's just being told to them straight from the source. So it's also about, as we were saying earlier, listening to the feedback and the criticism and not taking it with defensiveness, but acknowledging that there is learning to do from all sides of the table, and that it can be an opportunity, especially right now, to be more attentive to what the priorities of local actors are and how philanthropy can adjust to meet them despite the difficult circumstances.
It's interesting because I think up until the start of this year, I was definitely felt like kind of pretty optimistic about the kind of decolonizing journey that people were going on. I thought I saw some sort of wave of interest in the subject and apparent interest and intent in changing it. Unfortunately, everything that's happened this year means that it's hard to continue feeling that way, maybe because, yeah, as Dylan says, there is this kind of paralysis. But I feel like there are organizations that are going beyond their traditional ways of operating. And we talk a lot about flexible funding, but I've heard even someone like Oxfam, a classic establishment kind of NGO, they've done this work and they're doing stuff like participatory grant making.
Yeah. And also just to say that, of course, flexible, core, unrestricted funding long-term is key and essential to allow for the important work that local actors do, and especially the support that they need right now in these circumstances. But partnership, including with philanthropic actors, isn't just about money. It's about knowledge. It's about trust. It's about communication. It's about sharing the lessons that are learned together. And this is something that came out very clearly from partners during the consultation.
I was just brought back to a kind of conversation I had with a trustee of a kind of family foundation who we work with earlier this year. And I think, yeah, she said, oh, yeah, we've read your kind of reports on time to decolonize. We thought it was really interesting. And, you know, this organization who we've known for a few years, you know, they're quite conservative. You know, she said, oh, we've read this report and we're actually thinking about how we can change our practices for the better. It's not necessarily the people who are paid to go on these deep reflections and strategy weeks. It's just someone who does this in their spare time. If they can go through it as well, then I think it brings hope, in my view.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode on decolonizing philanthropy in the face of funding cuts. We'll be back soon with more perspectives from across the sector. Our thanks go to the Decolonizing Wealth Project for supporting this research, and to our guests today, Enrico LaRusso, Sam Crocker, and Dylan Matthews. I'm Jasmine Cato-Norton. You can find a link to our short guide on decolonizing philanthropy in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the podcast. It really helps others discover the show. This episode was made possible thanks to Jennifer Venice, Ravel Baines, Melina Villeneuve, Rahina Bodilla, Louise Morris, the hundreds of peace builders who contribute to our research, and of course to you, our listeners.